Monster Man, special episode, The Lords and Ladies of Faerie.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, Patreon backer Paul, who's asked me to talk about the rulers of the Fae, the She, the whatever you want to call them. We will call them, for the sake of argument, elves, but we'll go into more detail about what exactly that means as we go on. If you'd like to be like Paul and get your own special episode in which I talk about a topic of your choosing, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And in addition to your own episode, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, as well as other irregular bonus content. So Paul, thank you very much. I hope that you enjoy this episode. So Paul has given me a fairly broad brief to talk about the people who rule fairy kingdoms or elven kingdoms, you know, the upper classes, the nobility of the Fae. And in order to avoid just doing nothing but a survey of the sources, I'm going to limit myself to what I think are probably the three most popular examples of how these types of characters are treated, and then we'll talk about how to apply each of those concepts in games. The first and probably the most famous of these is, of course, the characters of Oberon and Titania in A Midsummer Night's Dream. They're the kind of archetypal king and queen of the fairies, and they do something very interesting, which is that they mix the kind of dignified nobility that we would expect from kind of high elven characters with absurd plots that puncture that dignity, and a bunch of, like, cottonly fairies, cutesy pie, flowers, and batwings stuff. Second, we're going to talk about Jareth, the Goblin King from Labyrinth. And third, we're going to talk about elven rulers in things like The Lord of the Rings. Because I suggest that each of these three portrayals of a fairy ruler represent slightly different, but still related, understandings of what that type of rulership means. And you can sort of mix and match those elements or choose between them in terms of how you present them in your role-playing games. Let's start with Oberon and Titania. These are characters that did have some precedent before they appear in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Oberon turns up in a number of kind of medieval, at least one, at least he's in Huon of Bordeaux, I want to say, and possibly in others. He turns up as a kind of fairy helper to the hero in these kind of medieval romances. I believe there are also grimoires that invoke him. I seem to recall that I went to a lecture by Dan Harms in which Dan talked about that, but it was a long time ago and I looked, but I couldn't find my notebook. Oberon and Titania are kind of the standard kings and queens of fairy. They appear in all sorts of other works. Just the other day, I was reading the Jamie McKelvey comic, Suburban Glamour, and there, the king and queen of fairy are called Oberon and Titania, even though they don't have any of the traits that the characters from the play have, just because, you know, that's who the king and queen of the fairies are. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, Oberon and Titania perform one of the functions that fae and elven characters most often perform. That is, they perform a heightened version of human passions and rivalries. They are at odds, and they are conscious of the fact that their being at odds is bad. They are supposed to be, on some cosmic level, supposed to be in harmony, but they've fallen out over a seemingly trivial issue. So here's Titania talking to Oberon in Act 2, Scene 1. "And never, since the middle summer spring, met we on hill, in dale, forest, or mead, by paved fountain or by rushy brook, or in the beached margin of the sea, to dance our ringlets to the whistling wind. But with thy brawls thou hast disturbed our sport. Therefore the winds, piping to us in vain, as in revenge, have sucked up from the sea contagious fogs, which falling in the land have every pelting river made so proud that they have overborne their continents. The ox hath therefore stretched his yoke in vain, the ploughman lost his sweat, and the green corn hath rotted ere his youth attained a beard. The fold stands empty in the drowned field, and crows are fatted with the Murrian flock. The nine men's morris is filled up with mud, and the quaint mazes in the wanton green, for lack of tread, are undistinguishable. The human mortals want their winter here. No night is now with him or Carol blessed. Therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air, that rheumatic diseases do abound. And through this distemperature we see the seasons alter, hoary-headed frosts far in the fresh lap of the crimson rose, etc., etc., etc. So the very natural balance is disturbed by the fact that Oberon and Titania are not getting on, and they're in dispute over a human. Titania has a boy who she's looking after, and Oberon wants him to be his, quote, henchman. Henchman just means a servant in this context. It doesn't have the sort of muscular implication that it would do today. So we go from this thing where Titania is a nature spirit, but here's her description of her relationship with the boy's mother. Set your heart at rest. The fairy land buys not the child of me. His mother was a votaress of my order, and in the spiced Indian air by night full often hath she gossiped by my side, and sat with me on Neptune's yellow sands, marking the embarked traders on the flood, when we have laughed to see the sails conceive and grow big-bellied with the wanton wind, which she, with pretty and with swimming gait following, her womb then rich with my young squire, would imitate and sail upon the land to fetch me trifles and return again as from a voyage rich with merchandise. But she, being mortal, of that boy did die, and for her sake do I rear up her boy, and for her sake I will not part with him. So on the one hand, we have a superhuman nature spirit, but on the other hand, we have these very human motivations for her connection to the boy. And throughout the play, that's what we're going to see, is this idea that Oberon and Titania are essentially exaggerated versions of quarreling humans, indeed, specifically of the quarreling humans who make up the other half of the play's cast. This is a pretty common conceit, the idea that Oberon and Titania are analogs of Theseus and Hippolyta. Indeed, if you saw the recent National Theater Midsummer Night's Dream, I mean, actually, I don't know that the production was recent, but when they put it on YouTube in the spring, and they're played by the same people. And I think that's a pretty common feature of productions of Midsummer Night's Dream. So, point number one, these immortal powers using mortals as proxies and pawns, a heightened version of mortal love and rivalry. Now, medieval sources often present the fairy kingdom as a place of heightened chivalry and courtesy, where, good people go to kind of have their virtues tested, of which more anon. All right, from the popular culture of one era, we move to the popular culture of another. I apologize if my voice sounds a bit funny here. I've got a vocal zone lozenge in. You can tell I'm a bit husky at the moment. Let's talk about Labyrinth. Now, a lot of people have told me that the presentation of David Bowie as Jareth in Labyrinth was kind of a central moment of the awakening of their sexuality. I think you have to be a certain age for that to have been the case. But, if you were at the right age when you first saw that movie, I think, because it's a film that is very much about desire and about the way that the Goblin King represents that desire, a desire for adulthood. One of the things about him is that as a character, he doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. And this is an idea that we have seen before with the portrayal of fairy and goblin characters. One thing that is a feature of elfish or fairy or otherwise supernatural characters is that they're close to human. They're not completely alien, but they combine normal and exotic in a way that is often done by mixing elements of childhood and adulthood, as we can see in Oberon and Titania being these dignified monarchs who at the same time, are a couple of frivolous, silly people falling in love with Bottom the Weaver and what have you. I have said before, and I don't wish to defend my contention here, that David Bowie as Jareth is actually kind of outperforming his brief in that the whole point of the Goblin King is supposed to be that his mystique sort of wears off, that what he offers is not really adulthood, but merely another kind of childhood. He's not an adult. He's a child's idea of an adult. And that idea, on closer examination, proves to be shallow. And the real adulthood, with all its complexities and responsibilities, ultimately more appealing. Essentially, he is a foil for a journey of self-discovery. But one way in which he is similar to Oberon and Titania is that he is very different from his subjects. He is this showman, this kind of dashing romantic figure who rules over this land of topsy-turvy, right? His subjects are not like him. His princely qualities are exaggerated to the same extent that they are roughneck qualities are exaggerated. And that fits with what we said earlier about A Midsummer Night's Dream, about the idea that what the fairies represent is a heightened version of human emotion and experience. So everything is much bigger. The Goblin King is a very extreme king, and his subjects are very unkingly indeed. So the idea that these noble creatures rule over a land of topsy-turvy, I think, is an interesting one, and one that is present in the Shakespeare, but not present in the next one that we're going to look at, which is the presentation of elven monarchs in The Lord of the Rings. If, like me, you are not a fan of elves, it's tricky to deal with Tolkien, because Tolkien represents the best-case scenario version of the elven whatever, right? Because in most games, how elves are presented is as humans with a coat of paint that you are supposed to accept makes them better. But it's an ascribed superiority. You are told how much better it is to be an elf. But this is never actually demonstrated, and indeed, when elves are playable characters, cannot really be demonstrated, and thus, they just come off as a bunch of snobs. Let's take a look at Tolkien's descriptions of Galadriel and Celeborn. This is from Lord of the Rings, Book 2, Chapter 7. So, Book 2, by which I mean it is in the first novel in the series, right? Lord of the Rings is actually broken up into 6 books. On 2 chairs beneath the bole of the tree and canopied by a living bough, there sat, side by side, Celeborn and Galadriel. They stood up to greet their guests, after the manner of elves, even those who were accounted mighty kings. Very tall they were, and the lady no less tall than the lord, and they were grave and beautiful. They were clad wholly in white, and the hair of the lady was of deep gold, and the hair of the Lord Celeborn was of silver, long and bright. But no sign of age was upon them, unless it were in the depths of their eyes, for these were keen as lances in the starlight, and yet profound, the wells of deep memory. If I had to summarize the way that the elven rulers, these ones anyway, there are others that are not so great, are presented in Tolkien, I would say that elven rulers are in reality, quote-unquote, how human rulers are in romance. So, writers present kings as noble and deep-minded and courageous and compassionate, and we all know that they're the same bunch of petty dirtbags that we all are. We all went to high school with at least one person capable of being Henry VIII. At least one. But probably not any capable of being Galadriel. So, this is a little bit tricky, because in fantasy role-playing games, we are dealing with a world of fiction. The human monarchs, the boring everyday monarchs, are often presented in that same romantic light. But if you want a good rule of thumb for how to make the idealized version, I would say that the monarchs or the rulers of the fairy folk are like a king is in a fairy tale. Which actually, again, goes back to Oberon and Titania, right? Heightened versions of human experience, and allows those kings to be good or bad, because there are wicked kings in fairy tales as well. And the wicked rulers of an elven community would be that kind of wicked. One of the problems that fantasy games face in dealing with the mysterious and exotic fae is that almost any interaction you can have with them tends to make them more human and therefore more mundane. And that's definitely the case in games where these characters are playable. It's hard to maintain the mystery and exoticism of the elves. You can actually see games reacting to this in things like the creation of the Eladrin. The Eladrin in D&D, what are they if not, well, elves have now lost their mystique, so we're going to bring in some elves that will still have their mystique, right? Eladrin are to elves as elves are to humans. But if we want our player characters to be suitably impressed by their interaction with these beings, then we need to present them in ways which restore that exoticism. I'm going to take 2 detours. The first is to an exhibit I went to many years ago now at the Royal Academy that was a John William Waterhouse exhibit. If I'm getting that name wrong, I apologize. I am not really a pre-Raphaelites guy, but Allison is much more knowledgeable about them than I am, and of kind of romantic art in general, early to mid-19th century stuff, knows more about it than I do. And we went to the Waterhouse exhibit, and I went because she wanted to go. But actually, when I got there, I felt like I understood it a little better. One of the things that the exhibit guide said was that Waterhouse was really influenced by stage design, so by scenic painting for plays. And I think that's dead right. I think if you Google up the image, Waterhouse, Circe offering the cup to Odysseus, and you look at that and you think, is this a bit like a staged set design? Then I think, yeah, absolutely it is. And I think that one way to give the world of the elves a bit of its weirdness back is to make it stagey. If we're going with the high elf version, everything in the high elf world should be a little too perfect. Why are there no pigeons crapping on these statues of ancient elven lords? You know, there's something slightly artificial, something operatic about these beings. Even if you're dealing with, you know, your wood elves, your more rustic down-to-earth guys, you know, it's always these beautiful Maxfield Parish skies. We human rangers are in the woods and we get, you know, twigs in our beards and mud on our boots and we're a bunch of, like, dirty, cutthroat, whatever. And then here come the elf rangers and they're, you know, a bunch of anime Robin Hoods. And we look at them and think, yeah, how do they do that? Now, there should always be that slight air of unreality and therefore of artificiality about them. They appear as we imagine them. The second point about stage is that sometimes it is best to keep these characters off stage. So an example of this would be Spenser's The Fairy Queen. One of the things that is very notable about Spenser's The Fairy Queen, this poem that it's actually incomplete. I mean, maybe the thing that I'm about to say would not have been true of the complete version, I don't know. But Edmund Spenser wrote this long poem called The Fairy Queen, and you know who's not in it? The Fairy Queen. Gloriana does not appear. And the reason that you can get away with that kind of expression of devotion to this offstage character is that the character is so idealized that essentially she becomes an ideal. We are talking about these characters' devotion to the principles and the ideals that that character symbolizes rather than to any flawed individual. If the dear leader were as great as the dear leader's advocates say, then it would be okay to have that kind of fanatical devotion to them. Now, in the real world, obviously, leaders are flawed and human, and it's not a good idea to be fanatically devoted to them. Indeed, people create these hyper-real versions of the people they admire so that they can justify the intensity of their devotion. One way to think about this is to look at the medieval literature of chivalry and look at the way that love and duty are conflated. Before you ever meet the Queen of the Elves, you should be standing in their last outpost, watching the bugbear hordes come ever closer. And the tall, noble, dignified captain of the fort turns to you and goes, "Adventurers, you are our one last hope. You must take the blue jewel and get it to safety where the Dark Lord cannot reach it. Like, only a scrappy ragtag band of heroes such as you could accomplish this perilous quest. And if the gods are on your side and you do eventually come to the court of the Queen of All Elves, tell her how we died." Dons his tall plumed helmet and he draws his gleaming longsword and he looks out at the filthy bugbear horde approaching, and all of his knights line up beside him and they all draw their longswords and with full hearts as one, they, "For the Queen!" and they charge, right? Like, that kind of devotion that is almost romantic is such a feature, first, of the medieval literature, and secondly, and I arguably more importantly, of the romantic reinterpretation of that medieval literature in the 19th century. 19th century artists and writers took the literature of the Middle Ages and they polished it smooth. They got rid of all the weird stuff. And that is where these elves come from those romantic portrayals of chivalry. So if you're running the kind of, like, dirtbag D&D that a lot of us tend to play, right, where the armor is battered and the characters are, you know, good-hearted maybe, but they got some rough spots and there are a lot of, like, scoundrels, and fights are dirty, and sometimes you win as much by luck as by heroism. To have proper elves who haven't been spending all their time around humans genuinely be like a 19th century kid's storybook about King Arthur, I think can really work. One of the key things that you have to do with these characters, one of the threads that runs through from Oberon and Titania to Galadriel and Celeborn to Jareth to every portrayal of fairy kings or kings of the other world in medieval romances, and you can see this in The Green Knight as well, is the way in which the ceremonial and the personal are blended. These are all characters who, although they are monarchs, are not concerned with affairs of state so much as affairs of the soul. So Oberon and Titania are fighting about something personal. Jareth ultimately is there to enable personal character growth, and the connection that Galadriel has with characters like Frodo, and particularly with Gimli, is, I mean, it's cosmic and it's intimate. Now, for you and me, for we mere mortals, those connections feel like a conflict. It feels weird to have things be cosmic and also intimate, because we are not cosmic creatures. We must elevate our minds to another plane to consider the cosmic context. But if you're the queen of the elves, that's not true. You exist on both those planes simultaneously. So you finally reach the end of your long quest, and you have come to the court of the queen of the elves. And in come the most beautiful maidens of faerie, and they're singing a beautiful song, and they're scattering blossoms. And then behind them a row of the royal guards, their tall spears gleaming in the candlelight. And then behind them, the queen of the elves, this beautiful, stately, imposing figure. But when she comes to talk to you, she says something insightful about you. She says something thoughtful and intimate. And that does not seem to be a contradiction to her or to anyone around her. Because when you are on that elevated plane, you understand the true significance of all these things. That the journey that the characters went through to get the blue jewel to your castle was not just a journey across mountains and through dungeons and evading pirate ships and getting out of the scorpion pits and fighting the fierce Naka and whatever, was ultimately a journey of the heart. And the nice thing about this, the cheeky thing about this, is that you can use this to invest your rambling picaresque with this sense of dignity. You can make it into a journey of the heart, even if it otherwise resists that characterization. Ooh, we got philosophical with that one, didn't we? Anyway, Paul, I hope that you enjoyed it. I wish I had not chosen so many primarily visual references for something that is ultimately an audio medium. Just as a reminder, if you'd like to be like Paul and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or if you'd prefer to pledge at another level, you can also do that and get the rewards associated with those tiers. If you'd like to support the show, but you don't feel like you can do so financially and in this economy, one thing that would be really helpful would be for you to leave a rating or a review, or I mean both, on the podcasting app of your choice. In our next episode, we're going to be hopefully finally doing what I said I would do earlier and answering some listener mail. So stay tuned for that right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.